Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Arnold Borgrave. I direct the Transnational Threats Project at CSIS. Welcome to what is phase two of our open source project, or what we euphemistically call the missing dimension of classified intelligence. First, let me thank our generous sponsors, Nadia Shadlow of the Smith-Richardson Foundation, also the Shelby Cullum Davis Foundation, BAE, Centra, and representatives from the Norwegian and Finnish governments, all great supporters of our work. And, of course, a very special vote of thanks to the gentleman on my right, Dick O'Neill, head of the Highlands Group, and another one who unfortunately couldn't make it at the last minute, John McGaffin. You all know him, and he's now with Centra. A week after the 9/11, the intelligence community warned that for America to defend itself from future attacks, it would need to work the dark side and get involved in mean, nasty, dangerous, and dirty business. Well, to augment that same goal, our parallel effort was clean, overt, and safe. The handcuffs are now off the ancient security structures that treated open source as an afterthought. There is no longer an argument about the critically important utility of open source. The challenge is what to exploit and how to facilitate the mining process. The near-total incompatibility between draconian security measures and the new global information environment prompted Tom Sanderson, my CSIS teammate, and me to embark on an extensive trip through Europe, North Africa, and the Middle East to confer with present and former intelligence and security chiefs, as well as a host of non-government specialists. We concluded that transnational terrorism would most probably compel intelligence services to morph from a bilateral to a multilateral methodology in real time. Sir Richard Dearlove, the former head of MI6, told us over dinner on his last day in office 3 years ago that this was an idea whose time had come, but it was probably still 5 to 10 years away, a timeline that would doubtless be shortened if and when confronted with a WMD act of terrorism. Instead, Sir Richard suggested we shift gears and look into a field he felt had been neglected since the rupture of the once seamless relationship between the intelligence community, academia, and the private sector, and which now seemed headed for a renaissance of sorts in the post-9/11 environment, especially as it pertained to the threat of Islamist extremism in Europe. When surveys show that 13% of the 1.8 million Muslims in the UK believe that 9/11 and 7705 in London were justified, that some 400,000 Pakistanis, British Pakistanis, travel to Pakistan every year, and that Richard Dearlove this very week said a complete rethink of the strategy to combat terrorism is urgently required, you get the instinctive feeling that our trusted information network, headed by Tom Sanderson, that our number is being called. You will find my thoughts on the magnitude of the extremist threat in Europe in my introduction to the report that will be released July 12th, an interim copy of which you received this morning. Down this road, our trusted information network, or TIN, could lead to a classified level, secure TIN, in which experienced intelligence professionals across services are able to have the sort of dialogue that characterized the discussions Tom and Jacqueline Harnett on his left and the TIN team generated across four continents. When you can't keep pace, you need external boosters, and that's what Tom and Jacqueline and their far-flung team have provided, and the team is here present too. So over to Tom to explain what was accomplished over the past 2 years and how this prototype created what could be used for a multitude of tough problems the world over. Tom, take it away.
Great. Thank you, Arno, and welcome to everyone, and thanks for joining us today for this this great discussion. And there's lots of folks in this room who are working on open source right now, and I'm glad to see them represented today, especially Saberhorn from the DNI's office, Ron Marks from Oxford Analytica, and our team members. In fact, I'd like to just point out the members of our TIN team that are here today. We'll start with Suzanne Spaulding on my left, Percy Laning as well. And then over here, of course, Dick O'Neill, Chuck Cogan, Jean-Luc Murray, Jim Harris, Tim Galpin, and are there other members that might not be sitting up front? I'm not sure. But thank you all for joining us today and for your contributions. Let me just give you a quick list of what I'll try to cover in the next 15 minutes. I'll keep it brief and then leave a lot of time for questions since we have a tremendous number of people here today. I'll go over the TIN goals very briefly, where I think the TIN fits in with intelligence community objectives, primarily with the United States, but also with our partners. And you'll see in the report when it's published the list of different intelligence, security, and law enforcement bodies that we briefed our results to and to whom we gave a TIN demonstration to around the world, I think at least a dozen different groups, the TIN-member list and their expertise, so you get an idea of why we chose the people we did and what sort of benefit they brought to the discussion. Talk a little bit about the mechanics of this, how we actually launched it, how we facilitated the discussion. And then up here, we'll give you a brief TIN demo to actually see how this came together and how people were able to engage in the discussion, share their information and their insights. And then we'll go into the actual content. What did we learn about our subject that we chose, which was the terror threat in Europe? And then what we learned about the process and management of a collaborative network, which, as it turns out, is the piece that interests many of our audiences the most, in fact, more than the content. And then we'll look to the future and see how we can use this TIN model, Trusted Information Network model, for other intelligence problems, for national security issues, and actually a range of activities that may not be national security oriented. Okay. Before I do that, I'd also like to recognize a couple of other individuals who helped us in the run-up to the development of the TIN, most particularly David Kay, who's here in the back, who through our meetings in Oslo and Brussels and for the 2 years in the run-up provided a tremendous amount of intellectual input to this. And so thank you, David, for joining us today. Okay, let me jump quickly now to the goals of the TIN. As Arno indicated, this is the second phase of a dedicated effort to look at open source information and its role in counterterrorism. One notion we hope that you depart with today is that this model that we ran for the last year can, in fact, be used for more than what we used it for. It can be used for a range of national security topics of interest to governments and actually to academic groups. Some of you, many of you, I hope, received a copy of this originally. This was our scoping effort that we've mentioned a couple of times that took place beginning in late 2004 with the interviews that Arno and I did, continuing up to a roundtable in March of last year. So that is available through our publications department upstairs on the fourth floor. Our goals were straightforward, both in that study and in the Trusted Information Network, and that was to look at the terror threat in Europe, the roles, activities, and impact of Islamist extremists in Europe, and to, one, look at using only open-source information and the insights generated from non-governmental specialists, what the implications of those activities are, and, number two, provide a template with lessons learned on how to manage a group of individuals geared towards or focused on that threat. So where does the TIN fit into intelligence community activities? There are mission objectives and there are enterprise objectives for the national intelligence strategy. One of the mission objectives, one of the five, is to develop innovative ways to penetrate and analyze the most difficult targets. One of the 10 enterprise objectives for the intelligence community is to strengthen analytical expertise, methods, and practices, tap expertise wherever it exists, and explore alternative analytic views. This is what the TIN is designed to meet. Now, admittedly, we did not design the TIN originally to meet those objectives, but a broader objective of providing outside expertise to analysts who are looking at very difficult problems. But as it turns out, happens that the TIN meets these two objectives quite clearly. I think you all have a copy of the membership of the TIN itself. And you've met some of those folks today. Let me just list those who were actual members. We have Scott Atran from the University of Michigan, specializes in suicide terrorism and Islamist groups. Dr. Maha Azam, associate fellow at Chatham House, who was originally from Egypt and covers political Islam in the Middle East, domestic politics, and regional issues. Chuck Kogan, who's over here on my right, longtime CIA employee and now at Harvard University. Anoush Etashami from Durham University, who specializes in Middle East politics and security. Avishag Gordon from Technion University, who's a specialist in searching the deep web and in information sources online for information on Islamist threats. Jim Harris from Centre Technology, former chief of strategic assessment groups in the Office of Transnational Issues at the CIA. Mark Huband, former bureau chief for the Financial Times in Cairo, as well as in West Africa, and then the chief security correspondent for the FT. Heidi Hootinen from the Finnish Institute of International Affairs, who's spent a lot of time working on how to engage moderate Islamist groups. Percy Laning to my left from Erasmus University, who focuses on democratic citizenship, civil society stability, and multicultural and ethnically diverse European context. This was tremendously important as we looked at what some of the sources are for radicalization within Europe, one of our most interesting elements in the study. Jean-Luc Marais, who's also to my right from Paris, who looks at WMD, Arab world conflicts, democratization, and cultural intelligence. Michael Tarnby from the Danish Institute of International Affairs, who is not with us today. And then we also had a number of advisors, Suzanne Spaulding, Dick O'Neill, Tim Galpin from Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Lab, and a number of other people who provided a lot of insight as to how a TIN could actually benefit government, what sort of ways to turn it, the dynamics of collaborative networks, elements of the threat in Europe. Had a very rich and textured group of individuals. What we wanted to do essentially was create a membership that reflected the widest variety of elements of the threat. We didn't want 15 people who were all specialists on the internet, or 15 people who were all specialists on immigration or the convergence of terror and crime. We wanted 15 competing views so that we could generate alternative hypotheses, competitive views on what was going on. And we think that we got that to a significant degree. Okay. Did I leave anyone out? I hope not. Okay. Great. Let me give you a little idea of how we came up with the membership that we did. Clearly, these individuals are known in their field. They have good reputations. They're widely published in scholarly journals. They're commentators, former intelligence officials. But what we did was we gathered our initial senior advisor group, David Kay, Suzanne, Dick O'Neill, Tim Galpin, and several others in Brussels for a workshop. And we brought in folks from all over Europe, the Middle East, North Africa, and others. And we gave them a scenario exercise, and that is, if you were in intelligence or in academia or consulting or whatever field you're in, and you want to look at the threat of returning fighters, Muslim extremists from Europe who've gone to Iraq to fight and are returning to their countries, where would you go for information? And we had them give us feedback on what organizations they would turn to, non-governmental, what sort of expertise, and individual experts. And so we built this network based on that feedback. Individuals who said, I would want to turn to this university, I would want to turn to this particular person, or I would want this kind of expertise to reach out to. And from that exercise in Brussels, that was May of 2005, we created this team of people. Now, there are lots of other individuals who could join it. We wanted to keep it at around 15 people, which we found to be definitely the limit to successful management for a small network like this. We then gathered the 10 members here in March of last year to launch the actual network. And we provided them all with a laptop loaded with a collaborative chat software called Groove Networks at the time. We had everyone come in for a training session for about 2 hours. Then we had everyone in the team go around the room and discuss their particular view on the threat in Europe. And then we let them know that over the next year, we would give them a set of questions roughly every 4 to 8 weeks, where we would ask them to go out and answer this question using only open source information, their own experience, their own work that they were doing, field work, writing, to conduct research on research, as Percy Laning mentioned, to look at what's out there in the conferences, in the literature, what they were hearing in conversations, but only unclassified open source information, essentially to provide a parallel set of responses and insights that could be compared to, in essence, what was going on inside intelligence communities to show how you could augment this effort. I'll now take you to the actual TIN to show you what people saw when they returned to their universities, when they returned to their jobs as writers, when they returned to their jobs working for immigration organizations, NGOs, and others, and to what they responded to. That's here. Incidentally, at the end of our report that'll be due out July 12 or 13, you'll find an excellent list in the back of our report on alternative technologies. This is a Groove software that we chose. There are, however, a number of other options out there, and Tim Galpin was particularly helpful in looking at alternative technologies to use for a collaborative environment like this. Essentially, here's the network itself. You'll see the names listed on the right, which includes CSIS staff, our senior advisors, Dick, Suzanne, and others, then the actual team members like Jean-Luc, like Percy, and then interns from CSIS and others. And essentially, you can connect to anyone on this simply by clicking on their name, and it automatically brings up an email ability, or you can click on the entire team to use his email as a communication device. The heart of the tin is here, and that is the discussion tab. And essentially, what we did was we posted a question here in blue, and we started off with the 50,000-foot level of the problem in Europe, and asked individuals in the team to, over the 4 to 6 weeks that we posted the question, to respond to it. And here you can see the threaded discussion by author and then by subtopic. People would respond to it. They would offer open source insights. They would say, we found a recent unclassified report from Dutch intelligence, or we found a document, a research document by a law firm in Italy that talked about funding. We recently conducted field research where we interviewed current extremists or former extremists. We've gone into prisons and talked to these individuals. We saw an article in Le Monde. Chuck Hogan was tremendous. Fluent French speaker who brought in a lot of information, as did our French-speaking member, Jean-Luc. And they would contribute these insights into the network, and then people would discuss them as appropriate as part of their normal daily work. You could return to a question at any point, but generally we tried to bracket them by putting one question out there per month or every 8 weeks and then have individuals respond to them. Let me just show you a couple of the responses here. Here's one by Jonathan Weiner in response to sleeper cells. Jonathan Weiner is an expert in terror finance, among many other subjects, former Assistant Secretary of State for International Law Enforcement. And individuals would come on here, provide their input, and then others in the network would challenge that, agree with that, augment it, and provide essentially a filtering process so that when information came in from the open source world, our network would be able to hash it over, talk about it, contribute to it, debunk it if they felt it was inaccurate or disinformation, and provide the input. Now, in addition to the discussion section, we also had a file section. And this is done by team member or by topics. And we had about 12 different topics in there. And we would say, in the course of answering the question, if you find any relevant information that would help that question in which you have reviewed yourself, please put it in your folder and in the topic folder. So again, here's Jonathan Weiner's contributions, a number of papers, number of documents that he picked up in his searching, in time that he spent on the counterterrorism blog, that he spent talking with other individuals, he would put on here, and then he would send a note to the whole team and say, I've just found X document that applies to question two, find it under here. And fortunately, a lot of our team members would say the relevant chapters are X or the relevant sections are this and that, which was tremendously helpful. A report from a group in the UK ran to, I think, several hundred pages, and one of our team members reviewed the entire piece and then said, it looks like for question number two, only chapter three in the second half of it is relevant. So we had a very, very helpful set of individuals who would take the question, look for the sources of information, and then filter in what they felt was the most important. Of course, that relies on their particular biases and whatnot, but nonetheless, very, very helpful system in doing this. Let me jump back to the discussion tab here, just so I can show you the other questions that were asked. We started off here with structural characteristics of the extremist networks that we know about. Generated a tremendous amount of threaded discussion. You may see these little flash bulbs on the left. For those of you who are very interested in how the process works, a flash bulb indicates that there's a new posting. If you pack up your laptop and you go back home to Rotterdam, you plug it into your high-speed network. Any additions that have been made, any contributions, insights, whether it's a document or a comment, appear as a new insight with a flashbulb on the right. Okay, so you can see that thread of discussion there. And it broke off into subjects about how important are links to Al-Qaeda, people talking about good works that were coming from a Norwegian institute, talking about evidence of sleeper cells. Then we move to a second question. You can see it there. What is the nature of the Islamist extremist presence in Muslim communities? And again, breaking off into subheadings, people going back to questions, adding this and that, tremendous amount of interesting insights that were generated about the Muslim Brotherhood, about violence in the Netherlands, prison radicalization. Then we jump to a question about the indicators of rising violence and extremist activities. The roles played by extremist fighters, again, our initial subject that helped us generate the TIN team. And then a provocative question by one of our early members, Mike Scheuer, who asked whether Europeans really understand the problem, or Americans for that matter, and it generated a lot of good, dynamic conversation. It, as you know, a very provocative, insightful individual. Then what we did after this large chunk of comment on four questions is we developed an analytical product. We looked at the four questions and we said, okay, it looks like members said this about the first four questions, and these documents were relevant. So we wrote up a fairly extensive analysis, which came here as the TIN assessment for April and May, and then sent it back into the group. We said, it looks like you said this about the following 10 subjects, and then had members debate it again. So a very good filtering process. First, they go out, find the information, their own work, others' work. Then they bring it in, they make an assessment. We write up a brief finding on that, and then we ask them to review that. And so this was one of the effective ways that the TIN was able to actually review content and then make discussions on it. Let me just show you a few pieces here. We would talk about the actual use of the TIN, go over each individual question, ask for individuals to respond to outstanding queries. People would say, I'd like to know some more information about the deep web, and we would ask two of our members to look at that. And so a very, very thorough examination of what went on inside. Okay. We also created an open comment tab later on where people wanted to be able to go and just add any comment that wasn't relevant to a posting. And again, one of the most important elements of this of the system over here was to be able to go over to Chuck Kogan and just click on his name and send him an email or add other individuals to that email as necessary. There was an instant message function on here, but none of that was recorded, so we did not use it that often. Okay. And we can come back to this as we see fit, but let's jump now to the content. So again, two main goals to this. What do we learn about the threat in Europe based on the open source contributions of these individuals? And what do we learn about the management of such an organization? Because again, we want to offer this as a template or a model to the intelligence community, to governments, to a range of audiences to say, we think it's important for a new range of threats to go outside of government and to go outside of classified information, to stand up a sounding board and to pitch these individuals a set of questions that parallel the questions being asked or mirror the questions being asked inside your institution to see what an organized group, when turned and focused against a particular subject, what sort of feedback that group could do. So let me just give you a few of the findings we had on content and then a few of the lessons learned from our actual operation of the TIN. Let me just say give you one caveat before I do this. What we envision in the future is the opportunity or ability for intelligence analysts and others in government to actually be a participant on the right side of that column there, to actually be able to interact directly with these experts. That, of course, is the big challenge, is how to get government folks to interact directly with non-governmental and non-American individuals. As such, the feedback that would come from a network like that would be rather immediate. Someone could go on, someone from the Counterterrorism Center could pose that question of what are the indicators of rising violence, and from the team get back a rather quick question. What I'm going to show you here is the content that's a compilation over a year. So some of these insights were generated more than a year ago. But our concept is that analysts could go on and immediately ask a question and presumably get an immediate answer right that day. And oftentimes that's what we would get from our most active members. When we put a question up there, they would respond very quickly. So regarding the threat in Europe, and based on the 8 questions that we asked individuals, we found some of the following highlights. Principal training, indoctrination, and organization of terrorist groups in Europe takes place locally and relies on internet information. We all know now quite well how powerful the internet role is. We learned some interesting things about that. A diminished role in radicalization conducted by imams and returning jihadists or local jihadists in favor of the internet, and specifically chat rooms being the most important and most potent element of the radicalization process. People often look to the physical manifestation of radicalization, that it's an imam, that it is an older man, an older militant in the population, that it's a returning fighter, few as they may be, as being the primary source of radicalization. In fact, we found, and others found through the research of others, that it's in the chat rooms and, of course, in the internet in general. Interestingly, the internet is increasing the roles and impact of women in militant activity, taking away that face-to-face contact provides women the opportunity to be more aggressive, to take a greater role in radical activity. Vital need for local interpretation of the threat. That's at the heart of the 10. It's individuals that you see around the room and others who've been working subjects for 10, 20, 30 years who are not on rotation as some government analysts may be, who are spending their lives looking at these topics, who are free to travel and free to engage, and have built trusted relationships with people such that they can walk into a prison and interview people and gather a lot of information. That local interpretation of the threat. Someone who, as Dick O'Neill's pointed out many times, can look at the graffiti on a wall in one of the poor neighborhoods outside of Paris and interpret that graffiti, who can look at rap lyrics or a rap video that's being used for recruitment and say, I think I see some trends in this, or I think this is telling us X, Y, and Z. You only get that from people who are local, on the scene, who are on the ground. The beat cop, the community social service worker, the author, the journalist, a whole range of people who live in country and travel frequently. One of the other interesting things that came up from this and was a source, an open source used quite frequently by a few of our members, is court transcripts and police interrogation transcripts. Not widely available, but publicly available to some degree, especially the court transcripts. Scott Atran used these a tremendous amount for his work. And a lot of them, he said, were highly relevant to 10 questions. However, they run into the thousands of pages. Again, that's one of the challenges of open sources, is boiling that down to the important information. So if you can find an individual who's scoured those court transcripts, provide a tremendous amount of insight. The Spanish police and intelligence who met with Scott Atran found that his work on the transcripts were more valuable than much of the work that they had gotten from their own police work. Tremendously interesting. Insufficient data to assess the role of returning fighters. That was actually the original focus of the 10 network, was to look at that question in whole. Thankfully, it was actually David Kay who said that should be a subset of the overall effort. And thank God we took that advice, because there is insufficient data to assess that role. We know that the role is very important, that these people come back as rock stars to Europe or other countries with charisma, with urban combat skills, counter-surveillance skills, disguising, bomb miniaturization. These individuals come back. This is anecdotal evidence. We know the numbers are small, but nonetheless insufficient data to assess what the impact is of these individuals at this point. Prison rape of Muslim men plays an incredibly strong role in radicalization. Not a comfortable thing to think about, but nonetheless a topic that came up quite often is what goes on in these prisons, where there's a large number of second and third generation North Africans in these prisons, the radicalization that takes place there, and the rape of these men that occurs has a very, very potent role in radicalization. Networking in prisons, very widespread, resulting in strong post-prison networking, as you often have in prisons worldwide. Management of public opinion in the organization of supporters serves as an indicator of impending action. It can be violent or nonviolent, but nonetheless, organization of public opinion within particular communities can be an important indicator. Self-starting terrorists often view as necessary a pilgrimage back to Pakistan, Afghanistan, and other countries as necessary before they undertake an activity. A point strongly reinforced by Jonathan Weiner's own research in the 10 and by several other members, that it's vital to get this blessing before you actually take upon an action like the July 7, 2005 bombing. Why is this relevant? Why is that important? Well, if you think it's absolutely essential to return to Pakistan, then you leave fingerprints and footprints. You have something that can be exploited. Logistical needs, moving money, moving people. As Arno said, 400,000 people going back to Pakistan every year from the UK. Those leave footprints that can be exploited. There are many other findings. I'll end with one, and that is foreign policy events. Let me back up a minute. We asked members, what are the sources of radicalization? That's one of the questions I didn't show you. Is it the local conditions? Is it the marginalization, the disenfranchisement of Muslim and Arab individuals, the unemployment, the racism in Europe? Is that the main fuel for marginalization, for radicalization and violence, or is it foreign policy events? We posted that question. We got a lot of good point and counterpoint in there. And several members submitted that they thought the foreign policy events, what's going on in Chechnya, Iraq, especially Israel, Palestine, Sudan, Afghanistan, played a larger role in radicalization than the local conditions. One of our members from British Aerospace who took part in this, Aaron Frank, described it this way. The local conditions, the marginalization, the ghettoization of these cultures in Europe, created the tinder, dried out the atmosphere, dried out the forest, in that the foreign policy events post 9/11 have been the spark that ignited this, and I thought that was a good way to put it. Let me now jump to findings on process and management. And this was really interesting for us, was to look at this and figure out how would you actually bring a group of individuals together, strong-willed, strong opinion, interesting people who all have diverse backgrounds and all have a primary job, a consulting job, a teaching job, people who are doing a range of activities, which made them appealing for TIN membership, but which makes it difficult to manage such a group and direct them for a year and maintain momentum and maintain positive feedback. So I'll talk about some of the things that we learned in managing these individuals. Dick O'Neill will probably spend a couple minutes talking about social networks and collaboration and that important element of keeping a network going. Technology is important, but it really comes down to the individuals in the group, the social dynamics of it, the collaborative nature of these networks. And that is really what's at the heart of this. Incentives for participation. With a year-long project, providing incentives to maintain the group is not difficult. Some need little incentive. In a way, these are self-selecting individuals. Yes, we asked them, we invited them in, but clearly these are people who would benefit and see benefit from their own participation in this. So in a way, you're out operating with an advantage. You're finding people who would want to be in such a network. But nonetheless, you still have to incentivize people. The work has to be to their benefit, fairly obvious, but nonetheless, you could get individuals who would join because it's of interest, but it has to benefit their work so that they see direct connections between what's going on in the TIN in the actual work that they're undertaking. We had a couple of individuals who wanted to do more on the Middle East. As it turned out, they participated less than other members. It was, in fact, on the threat in Europe. You have to have active participation from several members to keep it dynamic, to keep the conversation, the point-counterpoint debates, the alternative hypotheses, the challenges to information going, so that people look inside this and they say, hey, this is a healthy debate. I really like what's going on, and I'm learning a lot for myself. It has to generate new knowledge for the members and new knowledge, of course, for our audience. Team gatherings in interesting places. We brought people here, of course, twice. We had a midpoint in Brussels to discuss findings. But the most important finding we found, and this is reflected in what Tom Fingar learned in his Summer Hard Problems program last summer, is that individuals, as you see around the room, I think all of us want to know that our work outside of government is making an impact on policy, that the hard work that they're doing to answer these questions, to provide information, the work that they're doing is actually reaching policymakers, reaching analysts, reaching officials. In this iteration of the 10, our information goes to CSIS first and then goes to others through briefings. But in the future iteration that we hope will exist, that impact, that value will be much more immediate, where people are actually speaking to an analyst, where they can feel, you know what, my advice, my insight, the career I built, the PhD I earned, all of the work I'm doing, the field work, is actually going to an analyst and making that difference. Tremendously important that people in the network feel that they are making an impact on policy. Okay, this is a bit self-critical here, but the moderator, which was my job, is absolutely essential. You have to moderate full-time, something I was not able to do. In future TINs, you have to have someone who is constantly pruning the discussion, who's motivating members, who's turning the discussion. When one member says, I need information on the deep web, you turn to the Avishag Gordon at Tech 9 University and say, Avishag, can you do that? Someone may not be reading the 10 comments at all times. The moderator has to be there operating at all times with the help of some research associates. For a team of 15 people that Jacqueline and I managed and ran, it was tough. Even with the amount of information we got in there, managing that info, managing relationships, which is a lot of what's going on in there, and connecting people and pruning it is very difficult, and it takes an awful lot of work. We sat down with Dick O'Neill, who has long experience in collaborative networks, and talked to him. We said, Dick, you know, we have a couple people falling off. We really want 100% participation. He said, you will never get it. In a world of CNN and blogs and 24/7, people just will not have time to do that. You will get a consolidated core to this, the members who have the time and have the incentives to do that, and they will join. And Dick will maybe talk about a group called The Well out in San Francisco. That's one of the few examples of a persistent and successful network. But you have to have the moderator, and I can't emphasize that enough. You really need to have someone who is there reading it all the time. And again, that takes a lot of time because you've got members who are spread around the world at different time zones. So you have to be up all the time operating this. And we did it to the extent that we could, and we found that it was successful. A couple of other things we learned about process. Enhanced features make it a much more enjoyable experience for people. We experimented with something called VZ technology, and this is bringing video into the actual TIN network, into the group software. And when we were in Brussels, we had the founder of VZ in Palo Alto, Milton Chen, put up different videos of individuals using cameras attached to the computer to actually put someone's picture, live video feed of a member inside the TIN network. When you pull up the TIN, there's someone's face. And that dynamic interaction, face-to-face, essentially over camera, was something that we found to be very interesting. We experimented with it. We weren't able to eventually implement it, but that's something that I think improves it a lot. Some members said, we don't need that. We found that members would like that, the majority of them, and we found it to be very interesting ourselves. Another enhanced feature, guest speakers. We thought that it would be interesting to have a beat cop from Brixton in the UK or from a neighborhood outside of Amsterdam come on to the TIN for 3 hours at a scheduled time and answer questions from individuals to talk about what they're seeing on the road, or someone who's spent a lot of time in refugee camps or is working in the immigration issue, but to find other individuals, what you would call an agent on the periphery, someone who has particular and specific knowledge about a topic, bring them on as a guest speaker. There is a closed element to this, despite it being open source focus. This is a network that is invitation only, password protected software. We don't want everyone coming on this and looking at it. It's meant to drive a specific group with a focus. But bringing on individuals as guests would be something that I think would be very interesting. Deep analysis. Chuck Hogan in particular and a couple other members thought that it would be beneficial to the TIN to have individuals go off and do deeper analysis on a particular subject. Again, we asked these members, knowing that they were busy people, full-time, many responsibilities, to do research on research, provide insights on questions, but we didn't want to create a part-time job for individuals. But some people did want to take this deeper and look into things. The TIN, I should have said at the beginning, is not about defining actionable intelligence. What's going on the street at 3 o'clock tomorrow? It's about context and perspective, and that's what we want our members to provide. And, in fact, going into deeper analysis would have been interesting on a number of levels, but it's a lot to ask of individuals. But if they're nice enough to offer to do it and to do some of their own translation in doing that, it would be very welcome. Speaking of translation software would be very helpful. We have a number of French speakers, Arabic speakers in our group, Farsi speakers who are able to look at documents, Dutch speakers, look at documents, summarize them, and put them onto the network. But if you want to make this a more robust effort to bring in more information, maybe to scale up the project, you have to have translation software. Very, very important. Technology. It's got to be a seamless transition from this to the workspace of the TIN member so that they know that it's not an inconvenience for them to go from the laptop to their work. You can put it on your own desktop, but nonetheless, seamless technology transition. And again, speaking about technology, it was not user-friendly for some members. It was easy to use for other members. You have to find a technology that all members feel comfortable with, because that can be difficult. Some people are intimidated by new technologies. We had a training session, but to tell you the truth, it's not enough. You have to, I think, use a technology that people are comfortable with. Very important. Data storage. You saw the amount of documents that Jonathan Weiner posted from his subject. We had hundreds of documents posted. Groove is not searchable, for those of you who are thinking. There are other technologies that are searchable, and I think the future iteration of Groove will be searchable. But essentially, Jacqueline and I and our interns had to go through the information, read it all, and pull out the information, go through emails, go through the chat discussion. There was no search capability in that, and that's something to think about. Some of the positive and negatives we encountered beyond that. The TIN was a dynamic environment. You can see that just the small number of members we have here today provided a diverse background, multicultural, men and women, Muslim, Christian, Jewish, from lots of different countries, people who provided a great context. And that is what we wanted to get at, was 15 different angles on the subject. Effective vetting of sources. I described that to you. TIN members go out, pull in information, discuss it. We write an assessment, throw it back into the TIN. They evaluate the assessment. Very good vetting of information, point and counterpoint. Field work performed by TIN members was put into this prior to publication. That was one of the most valuable aspects. We saw the four or five intelligence members, former intelligence officials in the TIN, looked at some of Scott Atran's work and some of the other work that was put in there, from interviews he just did that week in Peshawar or in Gaza and in Indonesia. Tremendously good on-the-ground information was put right into the TIN, and you can envision a future model of this where this is encouraged even more, or where TIN members who are currently conducting field work are brought in to do this, and you can get an awful lot of good information. The TIN could be directed to new areas of interest. That's one of the roles of the moderator, but also the TIN itself. After looking at the first four questions, where should we go? You would ask the TIN, you would ask the advisors, and you could steer the TIN in that direction. A very, very movable and directable organization, which was interesting. Again, you have to think about incentives. Is it moving in a direction that excludes the interests of half the members? That's something to be considered. But it's a small team, lean and mean, and able to be turned to different areas. Size. 15 members is what we started out with. As well as several advisors. That is the max that we think would be helpful, and we had, in fact, asked our members what they thought of the size, and they said maybe even smaller because of the amount of information that's out there. 2 to 3 members, suggested by Suzanne Spaulding, but others as well, should be very young members of the TIN team. You have to have people who are very comfortable surfing the internet, who are blogging, who are out there, in touch with popular culture. We had one of our German interns go onto a website called muslimmarkt.de. This is a website for German-speaking Muslims in Austria, Germany, and Switzerland. They talk about culture, they talk about sex, they talk about food, they talk about Palestine, they talk about Iraq, everything that's of interest to these individuals. You've got to have people who are familiar with this world, with the online world, with the deep web world, who can go out there and say, these are some of the undercurrents we're seeing. People who either visit these sites or run these websites. Very, very important to have those individuals on there. also just for their adeptness in technology. Looking ahead, and I'll conclude with this, and then we'll open it up to questions and maybe some comments from Dick O'Neill and others who are around the table. The TINS ability to serve as a dependable source of insight and expertise was unquestioned. We found throughout the process, even with ebbs and flows of activity, that with a foreign policy event, with a bombing somewhere, with a decision by GSPC to change its name, all of these things elicited tremendous amount of comment and insight from people who are, again, on the ground, smelling the dirt, talking to the people in the prisons, at the conferences, networking with intelligence agencies, people who really are roving experts, agents on the periphery who just pull in tremendous amount of information. We found that to be successful. We found it to be a real hallmark of the TIN and something that we think proves the value of this. The hurdle, as I mentioned, is getting to the point where we can actually more closely connect government analysts with these individuals that you see in the room and that are in the TIN for that immediate feedback so that you're not getting an evaluation 6 months later or a year later where you can get that immediate feedback to meet those mission objectives and that enterprise objectives of tapping expertise wherever it is, not just within your group, which again, no group think in something like the TIN where you have competing members, intellectually competing, professionally competitive, no group think. Where you have that ability to scour the open source, bring it in, and provide the context and perspective that you may not get in government or that augments what you get in government. And that is what we found at the heart of this. It can be used to cue analysis work, to cue operations, to bring things into better perspective. We spent 50 years facing a threat that we could conduct a net assessment against. We could count their tanks. We knew who was in the Politburo. We knew how to deter the Soviet Union. It was a fixed group with a border. We're now dealing with a threat that has none of those attributes. And because of that, you have to go outside and tap this expertise. And I'll end with that and maybe get some comments from Dick on collaborative networks, and then we'll take questions from you folks. Thanks.
Before Dick says anything, for those of you who don't know who he is, and that's very few people, I'm sure, in this room, but he's one of the most remarkable individuals I've met in 61 years of professional life. He runs an extraordinary group, 500-600 of the most unusual people in the country who can think out of the box, look over the horizon, doesn't matter whether they're script writers in Hollywood or CEOs in Chicago. He's pulled them all together, and he's managed to do this because he is the extraordinary person that he is. There you go.
I feel like I'm at my own funeral. Thanks, Arno. I really don't have an awful lot to add to what Tom said. I mean, he covered it very well. I would like to reemphasize a couple of major points. I mean, people ask, why do this? You know, what's new? You know, we collaborate. We've always looked at open source information, so there's not much new there. In fact, there are a few things that are new that do make this somewhat different and make the process that Tom and Arno and Jacqueline put this group through somewhat different. And I think it's worth calling attention to that first before even a mention of some of the other points Tom made. If you think about the diffusion of power that's taken place from states being joined by non-state actors, whether they're NGOs, whether they're non-state groups, whether they're individuals, that diffusion of power has taken hold of us in a security situation as we've seen over the last 7 or 8 years. That's been quite significant. But it was mirrored at the same time by the notion of the technology Tom talked about, this decentralizing of technology. In particular, you had the democratization of tools of production. That's the PC. You had lowered costs of consumption, which allowed for democratizing of the tools of distribution. That's the Internet. And the ability to connect people to a variety of sources. And what that really resulted in are the things that we're seeing, like Time Magazine's Man of the Year this past year was a mirror, and it's about you. What that really means is it's user-generated content. So lots of people are generating lots of content. And in earlier days, that may have been a nice footnote to the power relationships that exist in the world. But in fact, they now either govern or spur or fuel many of those power relationships. And those same tools that allow that compel us to use those tools to find that information because, frankly, we're not structured to look at that information in the way that our prioritization schemes work and our funding schemes work to be able to collect information. So there's a broader need out there that has to be recognized on this information. Much of it is open source. I would say Tom mentioned a couple of things I think are really very important and almost entirely overlooked by almost everyone. The first is this notion of unobtrusive measures. And that's just a nice phrase that sociologists use, meaning surrogates for something. So if you think about the cop on the beat who has the immediate access to graffiti on the wall outside the ghettos in Marseille, or somebody who's actually listening or paying attention to the rap videos on YouTube or is listening to a pirated disc that was made in somebody's basement in Paris that talks about what they're going to do in the riots that are going to ensue within the next 6 weeks or so against the police, against the landlords in the ghettos, and exactly how they're going to do it. They're sort of leading indicators that are interesting but probably overlooked by almost everyone. So being able to look at these unobtrusive measures, and these are just two sort of unusual ones, but there are many more, allow you to do what Margaret Mead talked about and Tom mentioned, the term smelling the dirt. You know, this is culture at a distance. This is anthropology at a distance. It allows people who have expertise, immediate expertise, and people who are spending a lot of time on these topics of research to actually be of great value to us to add texture to what it is we are already reading or collecting, or in some cases not reading and not collecting and being the sole source of these things. So I think that those elements alone make it important, make it critical to do something like CSIS has done with this network, and we're starting to see more and more of these trusted networks develop around affinities. Tom mentioned the well has been going on. I can't even recall the inception date of that now. Stuart Brand and a variety of the Merry Pranksters starting this network of exchange of information in San Francisco long before really the Internet's preeminence. But it's because people want to share information. That is what networks really are about. They're social, they're exchange of ideas, exchange of information, and harnessing that is what's been so critical about what CSIS has done here, even on a small basis. So the big question that gets raised is, does this scale? And that's a very difficult question to ask and answer. I don't know the answer to that. I will tell you that most networks that we've actually looked at in globally have failed over time because people wither away, lose interest, the topic goes away. People are flat busy, and Tom's point about moderation or facilitation is spot on. Without someone there to constantly be a manager, a cheerleader, an interrogator, a collator of information, it's very difficult to accomplish this. Now, that's true in external organizations or affinity groups where it's a part-time occupation, avocation. We don't know the answer to how that would work in something like the intelligence community as we start to adopt these kinds of tools and these processes where Wikipedia becomes Intellipedia, where a number of analysts are working 24/7 on something which an outside group like this might be considered an affinity group. Would it work without full moderation, full facilitation? Would it work any better over a long period of time at scale if it is your full-time responsibility? Or, to Tom's point, would you end up more in a group like that, where it is your full-time occupation, would you end up more with groupthink than if you had a variety of built-in N number of team Bs in the process of this 15 individual researchers who do have different backgrounds, different points of view, different ego rationales for their points of views? Would it be any different? So these are unanswered questions. They're very difficult to address and answer, but they are the kinds of things that make up what we traditionally do. We like to share information other than when our organizations make it disincentive to share information, and we find information as an element of power that we hold on to for long periods of time until we estimate on our own individual curves what the decay point is for that piece of information when it's really no longer as useful. And it will not bring us that same value that we first had when we first got hold of it and decided to hang on to it and not share it. So there are those pieces of competition that are really essential to understand that need to change and are changing in the intelligence community that we mapped within the 10 that I think are so valuable. So it's this notion of collaboration, sharing. These are age-old kinds of approaches to people gathering together. But now the tools and the needs and the organizational constructs are such that we really don't have much choice, and we have to get better at this. And it's not just getting better in the intelligence community. It's getting better everywhere at doing this for every organization so that we not only achieve efficiencies of operation, but so that we are better at everything that we do. And I think the 10 was a very, very good first step at doing that, and clearly the findings that they've come up with, some are very new. Some are reemphasizing these key points that we've known for a long time, but in a new setting. So I think that this was a really valuable experience for us.
Great. Thanks. Well, go ahead, Arnold. Let's open it up. And please identify yourself and your organization.
Yes, I'm David Abramson, and I work in the Bureau of Intelligence and Research at the State Department.
Great.
You mentioned anthropology at a distance, and I was just wondering to what extent that you reached out, and I don't know if any of the members of the group of 15 are anthropologists, but you said that local experts, people who are familiar with what's on the ground, were your best sources. And I'm just wondering to what extent you included anthropologists or considered working with anthropologists who are both often active local experts as well as are familiar with what's going on here. And I know that a lot of anthropologists are squeamish about working with intelligence, but the finding you had about noting that prison rape of Muslim men radicalizes is actually a point, a kind of human rights point that would probably appeal to a lot of anthropologists.
It's a great topic, and if you didn't read it, the December 13 or 14 New Yorker issue had an article by George Packer where he essentially spoke about David Kilcullen, the cultural anthropologist who's now a senior advisor to General Petraeus and was Hank Crumpton's senior counterinsurgency advisor, an Australian Army captain as well, good friends with Sabra Horn. And Sabra and I have actually been discussing that article and several of the people who are in the article quite a bit about this cultural anthropology link to counterterrorism, counterinsurgency, and understanding, knowing the enemy, which was the title of the article. And there's quite a bit out there. We do have an anthropologist on the 10, that's Scott Atran, who was one of the most active members, who is the one who provided that field research directly into the 10 before publication, before anything, where he took his laptop with him and after doing his work in cities would send us all blasts. And I know quite a few members read that and said, this is dynamite work. And so we do focus on that element. And in a future 10, I would like to have more, no doubt about it. The variety is so important. But we certainly did make sure we had an anthropologist in that. Again, is Scott Atran, who splits his time between the University of Michigan and Paris. Okay, next question.
Ray Decker, Center for National Security at OPM. First, I want to commend CSIS on this very important initiative. I think it's long overdue. My question has to do with sources, because one of the highlights of your initiative is the vetting of sources. Two-part question. Did you attempt to create a process to grade or rate sources based upon accuracy, reliability, past reporting? And if not, why? And the second part is, did you have any evidence of disinformation through your analysis of the different sources that was effective in any way?
Those are fantastic questions. And when we did the, I'm not sure how many, but 20-plus briefings to U.S. intelligence folks and Germans and Singapore and U.K. and France and others, Dutch, we got that question all the time, and we get it from non-governmental folks who ask us all the time. And did we grade the sources or vet them in any way? Well, our sources are our 10 members, and then we rely on their expertise, their experience, their judgment to look at information that they pick up in their daily work to answer that question as the first line of vetting. And so we rely on individual judgment, and then it would be brought into the 10, and we would rely on collective judgment and collective vetting of people who would say that document does not appear to be accurate or whatnot. We did not see any evidence of disinformation. I don't remember anyone in particular bringing that to me. If there are members here who may have had discussions offline, please let me know. But no attempt. John McGaffin, who is not here today, unfortunately, but is a co-author of our last report and a primary advisor on this, always would say to in response to that question during briefings, he would say, he was in covert operations for 35 years at the CIA, and he would say, there's no difference between the accuracy of information, whether it's stolen or whether you pull it out of the New York Times. He said, just because I could steal something out of the defense minister's safe or overhear a conversation doesn't mean that that conversation that I eavesdropped on was not also inaccurate. You have to use your own judgment. You have to assume there's going to be amount of misinformation, disinformation, and then you have to rely on your own process, analysis process, to vet that. I think we had a dynamite process, and I think maybe Jim Harris is going to make a comment on this, but several filters are in the 10. The initial individual who goes out to find the info, the group, CSIS, and then we throw it back to the group. But it's a great question.
I was just going to offer a couple of observations. First of all, I remember about, I don't know, 2 or 3 weeks into it, getting on one day at my desk on the Groove Network and just surveying the documents that we'd acquired already. And it was pretty stunning how interesting some of this stuff was. I hadn't seen it before. You mentioned some Scott Atran's briefings, and you mentioned court transcript analysis and so forth. And those were in the early days of the network when you really hadn't polished it yet, and we really weren't that well organized, but we were starting to do our thing. And my observation was you got pretty good results really quickly, and you don't need a perfect network in order to achieve that. It can be pretty ragged. All you need is a bunch of enthused people with expertise, and things come together very rapidly, and it was very valuable. And the second observation is that there are going to be some people in the intelligence community who are going to be tempted to think that this is like the same. It has the same fruits of the sort of well-motivated researcher. And that if you just got a couple of well-motivated researchers in the IC, you produce pretty much the same kind of insight. But the truth is, it's very different because you get your hands on very different material. You mentioned unpublished documents, again, the court transcripts, all of the material that we don't generally see that does appear on the Trusted Information Network that really gives it its own flavor. It's just a very different kind of thing, and I think intelligence community program managers have to understand that. This is not the same thing as having an analyst in your unit going out and searching open source. It's, in a way, it's a lot more powerful because you're using intelligent agents to sort of evaluate and acquire and act at in your behalf, and that generates something that's, I think, very, very different.
Jim, and it is true, the flexibility that 10 members have to search open source is essentially unlimited. You can have Anoush Etteshami in our network interact with the Persian-Iranian community in the UK or in France in a way that an intelligence officer can't. Same with Maha Azam with the Egyptian community or meeting with Muslim Brotherhood individuals. That flexibility was a real hallmark of it. David?
David Lowe recently retired as National Intelligence Officer for Transnational Threats at the NIC. I'd like to just comment on a couple aspects of it, too, as a practitioner. First of all, to completely support the premise of this, which is that significant amount of information that any analyst needs exists outside of the intelligence community. As NIO, I would spend at least 25% of my time traveling or meeting with outside experts, academics around the world, conferences, reading their materials and interacting with them, because the day-to-day tactical focus that dominates intelligence analysis gets in the way. I call it the tyranny of the urgent. And the NIC had the responsibility to be more strategic and to try to understand these issues from a much more strategic perspective, which is what you're addressing when you bring in sociology, anthropology, which I tried thoroughly to do. The problem becomes, of course, how do you create an interchange, a feedback mechanism on that, and that is non-trivial. We explored, for example, in some contexts, getting other government agencies' analysts to create something parallel to this. And there was tremendous resistance. I'm sure you've talked to some of the same people, including something as trivial as there are just not that many PCs on desks around the world as there are in the United States. But in any event, I think that the fundamental premise is essential, that this kind of outside understanding and networking is critical. Secondly, I think even though you point out that this is not designed for actionable intelligence, there is a sense in which it is a precursor to things that will need to be happening both inside and outside of the intelligence community at a much greater scale over time. For example, I personally very strongly believe that this notion of integrating analysis from the broad perspective of academe and even intelligence, hard intelligence, with the local knowledge of the street and the police and the domestic observation of what's going on day to day is the future of our approach to how we answer this. There are people in government right now who would laugh at the notion that the cop on the beat ends up being an essential part of strategic intelligence analysis, but I'm firmly convinced that that's where we have to go, at both inside and outside of the intelligence or DHS and other FBI agencies. So how that happens is a huge question, and you are leading the way in a small way but an important way to start learning some of the advantages and challenges. And last thought is maybe there are perhaps certain issues which are more generalized that one could focus on, for example, radicalization or sort of viral expansion mechanisms. There are certain things that take place that we don't understand very well yet where these forums would have more relevance than something such as the topic that you actually chose, which probably more traditional mechanisms would explain.
Thanks for that great feedback. And if I can just jump to an issue that you brought up, and that is the local cop on the beat. We happen to be joined here by a couple of federal agents from the German federal police. And they took part, Klaus and Stefan, took part in a project that we did to look at how law enforcement engages Muslim communities. It came from a lecture I did at Interpol headquarters in April, and I interviewed Klaus and Stefan and then police in six different countries to say, how is it that you go out and engage Muslim communities? And one of the individuals that I interviewed who then came in for a roundtable here was a Dutch police officer who was the precinct commander in Mohamed Bouyeri's neighborhood in Amsterdam. Mohamed Bouyeri killed Theo van Gogh for making the movie he did called Submission. And so we brought these gentlemen in and talked about that. And these guys, they know what's going on. I mean, they are literally are walking the beat. They see the graffiti, the unobtrusive measures. They hear the music coming out of the windows. They know when things are out of place. And they are often the only point of contact between these disenfranchised Muslim and Arab men in government. The only point of contact, which puts them in an incredibly pivotal position in creating an atmosphere, but also in getting valuable intelligence. So great point for bringing that up, David.
I'd just like to add a word on this subject of proximity police regarding France. As you may know, France is one of the most heavily policed countries in the world because there is a dialectic operating in France between a vertical and authoritarian structure on the one hand, and anarchy in the street on the other. There's nothing between the king, who's the president, and the street. The parliament is weak, so they have to have a strong police system. And they have a particular organization that's called Renseignement Général, which is General Intelligence, and that is essentially a political police. I think it was created by Napoleon. Jean-Luc can correct me. But at any rate, these are the people who are in the ghettos, which are in the suburbs in France, and they not only are very close to these immigrant milieu, but also they run penetration operations into these communities. So I think that they have an excellent access right on the ground to these rioters. The second point is that because there is so much latent violence on the street in France, the police have to be extremely careful, as otherwise these riots can get out of hand. And in the riots of last year, it's interesting that the only two people who were killed were two youths who ran into a transformer station and got electrocuted. In all those riots and car burnings, there was not a single other fatality.
Thanks, Chuck. Next question, Ron Marks.
Yeah, Ron Marks from Oxford Analytica. This is for Dick. Dick, a lot of these systems, or any of these systems, have form of cultural bias in one way, shape, or form. As I look on that, as I look around this room, we're all about 1 degree separated from each other. As I look up at that chart, we're all about a half a degree separated from each other. How do you correct in a system like this to sort of move outside that social bias? I mean, clearly we have a group of educated Western people who are involved in this network trying to make some assumptions or thoughts or insights into people who clearly are not from that culture. I mean, how do you take that into account as you're doing this?
I think you do. You have to. And in this case, this was more institutional diversity than it was individual diversity, I think. But the point is, as you scale to networks or as you start to pull these networks together, if you're truly interested for lots of a richness in the points of view, you do look vertically and horizontally. You do look nationally. You look at a variety of means to do that. In fairness to the way that this was done, this is truly an opening experiment to check on process and technology. And without looking at what the ultimate product was going to represent in terms of that several degrees of separation and richness that you described, I think that was the success factor. I think going forward, any kind of effort like this, whether it's in the intelligence community or whether it's outside and it's from a think tank or just any kind of an institution that is going to attempt a network, you're going to have varying degrees of, I wouldn't say success, because I don't think you can shortchange any process to say you're not going to be successful unless you have X degrees of diversity. But I think you have a greater opportunity for richness in the discussion, in the differentiation of points of view by more organizational, individual, and vertical and horizontal diversity as much as you can find. I think that's an essential point that you raise. Yeah.
Great. Thank you. Along the wall.
Hi there. I'm Adam Berkovich. I'm working at CSIS for the summer. And you mentioned a lot of the problems associated with managing the network and moderating, as well as kind of researching the massive articles like the transcripts and proceedings. What do you think
as far as an implementation step, what do you think would be the appropriate kind of vehicle for running the system? Would it be more of a private nonprofit organization, governmental-run corporation, that sort of thing?
Well, there's a variety of ways that it can be done, and we offer an initial model, a prototype, a test bed that, of course, is run by CSIS. We see one in the future where the intelligence community is directly involved, where think tanks are the bridge. There's a whole range of ways that you could do that. But to meet some of those incentives and needs of the members, of course, having the version that where there's direct interaction with the intelligence community is better, but that happens to be the most difficult one in which to secure. So a lot of ways. Suzanne?
Yeah, I just wanted to emphasize again, picking up from Jim Harris's comments about why you can't just hire some good research associates and accomplish the same objective, is that obviously, as you emphasized in your remarks, it's not just about locating documents and bits of information. The discussion piece of it is really critical. It is that dynamic exchange of ideas, opinions, thoughts, analysis, and questions, perhaps most of all, that helps to create new knowledge. So it's not just a question of finding what's out there. It's really a question of bringing a group together who by their interaction with each other, will each walk away from it with new knowledge, new understanding, having thought of something that maybe hadn't been thought of before. And some of those aha moments are just in developing questions. And that was one of the things I thought Jonathan was so terrific at. He would, post some interesting insight, but he almost always ended with a question of, okay, this gets me this far. The next thing then that I don't know from that is X, and what do you guys think about this? And that leads me to thinking about the next stage and the ambition of this becoming something that the intelligence analysts, not just in the U.S. potentially, but around the world, could participate in and be part of that dynamic, raises a number of interesting issues, not the least of which, as a lawyer in the intelligence community for 20 years, the issue of tasking Americans, which I think would be a challenge. And it may be that the easiest first step is to lurk, is to have the intelligence community as observers on a network as you sort of work through those potential issues. But the other advantage to not having the intelligence community, while it's tempting to think that it would be great to have the intelligence community be able to ask these questions and these people would sort of, answer them right away, is that you begin to I worry that you lose that question formulation by the tin.
Yeah.
One of the challenges for intelligence community analysts, I think, is to not be so preoccupied with answering questions that officials ask that they aren't in a position to think about what are the questions that should be asked. And I think that's a value of the TIN.
Great. Thanks, Suzanne. And that came up in several of our briefings with the intelligence community, and that was the versions that they felt would be most helpful were ones where CSIS or other think tanks were managing that process. So you would have government folks lurking or participating, you'd have the TIN membership, but you'd have it driven by an outside group.
Oh, and the other next stage that you might think about is having a TIN of just government officials from around the world. You might have a bunch of those cops on the beat who have created a TIN.
Yeah, absolutely. Next question. Yep, Russ Howard.
I'm Russ Howard from the Jepson Center at the Fletcher School. Are you planning to use this model for other geographical areas?
We are. We have submitted a proposal at the invitation of an allied intelligence community, and we expect to move on that in the next couple of months to see where that'll head. But it's something that I've briefed overseas several times, as I mentioned. And in one of those groups, in fact, two or three members of this country's intelligence community specifically want to look at transnational threats writ large, terrorism, crime, trafficking, and to have us bring together a group of experts who can act as a sounding board. So that is one thing that we are looking to move on to. So answer is yes. Yes, Jim.
Jim Delaney from IDA. Tom, when is the TIN discussion? discovered in the way of things that are keeping the terrorists off balance? I mean, the perception out there is that we're on the defensive, and that they have the initiative. But what have your findings revealed in the way of things that worry the terrorists, and which suggests offensive measures by the countermeasures that this is working?
I'm going to draw on knowledge that I've developed through working with individuals in this room that came from outside of the tin, but that's a great question. And when asked a similar question, why we haven't seen a major attack in the United States since 9/11, one of the elements is that there's a perception on the terrorist part that we are doing well, that we are omniscient, omnipresent, omnipotent, when that student at UNC Chapel Hill took his truck and ran over a few students a couple of years ago on campus. When the police interviewed him and said, "Why didn't you buy a gun instead of using your truck?" he said, "I assumed I was under surveillance." So there's a perception on the terrorist side that our shields are up, that we're doing well, you know, and which is, you know, accurate to a degree, depending on what you're talking about. We do have effective counterterrorism operations, but certainly in Europe, where surveillance, especially in the UK and France, is high, I think that keeps them off balance to a degree, knowing that they are being watched. But I'll let others make comments. I think Arno and Dick might make a comment there.
I think one of the most significant things that came to our attention is how they have moved from the radicalization of youth through the mosque to the internet, and John Negroponte once asked me, do you know what a petabyte is? I had no idea. He said, a petabyte, just think of the entire Library of Congress with 130 million items, 10,000 new ones every day, 535 miles of shelf space. All of that, he said, represents 0.02 petabytes, whereas what's moving through cyberspace in any 24-hour period is 627 petabytes, estimated. And trying to find what the bad guys are up to in that global soup is a huge challenge. So they've moved from the mosque to the internet, where it's much harder to track what they're doing.
Jumping back to that, Jim, I'm not sure there's much that does keep them off balance other than just the sheer difficulty of bringing together a group, of creating a plan and executing that plan in a less than permissive environment now, where people are looking for that, where security services. But I think that they believe it's relatively doable to pull off these operations. They do see, you know, Operation Crevice, where they were able to foil an operation. They do see these victories by our security services, and I think that does give them caution. But I think a lot of them are imbued with a sense of infallibility, motivated by 9/11, motivated by Iraq, motivated by bin Laden's message, his concept that Islam is under attack. So I don't think there's much that does keep them off balance other than practical issues and this perception among some that we know more than we do, or that we're doing quite well. So it's a tough question to answer, actually. Yes. Who would manage which information technology?
The increasing technologies of communication via the internet and its sort of rapid expansion.
It's the Wild West. I don't think you can manage it. I mean, it's just, there, you've got several thousand, who knows the number, anywhere between 3,000 and 5,000 pro al-Qaeda websites. You've got satellite dishes on top of shanty shacks that have no running water. When Arno and I were in Morocco interviewing individuals, we would drive by these towns with these corrugated metal shacks that clearly, you know, had no running water, but there's a satellite dish on every one of them. It's ubiquitous. It's powerful. It's redundant. It's a double-edged sword. We can't shut it down because it's our economy. It is without. It's one of the biggest ungoverned spaces out there. It happens to be virtual. I think it is one of our biggest problems in countering this threat. And if you look at Mark Sageman's work on chat rooms, very, very good, and he really focuses on that. But I don't see much that can be done, and I'd be happy to. I see David Lowe shaking his head, and I'd be happy to hear other comments from folks on this. Yep, go ahead. There's no way for us to know what communication took place between members if they did not copy me or Jacqueline or Arno. Yep. No, I'm giving you some feedback. So there's no way to know how much actual communication took place. We would ask them, but you know, it's difficult. There's no record unless I'm copied on it, and I think I was copied quite frequently on instant message. You know, that's handy if you want to have that kind of interaction. But again, there's no record, which is a detriment for us in trying to pull insights from that. And I think very few people used it. I did not hear that being used quite often. But back to your incentive, being published in a CSIS report or in another think tank's report was also an incentive that we forgot to mention, and that is, you know, of benefit to individuals. We also talked about incentives such as providing honoraria for the most active members, but these are far less important than the more substantive aspect of making an impact, of knowing that David Lowe would sit down with a group like this and actually listen to their feedback and then, you know, have that filter into a national intelligence estimate, that kind of thing.
Is it at the back?
Yep, go ahead. That's the million-dollar question, and that's partly why we have Suzanne Spalding in our group, having spent 20 years at the agency in the general counsel's office. There are other groups who have done this. There are, I mean, you can use CSIS as the bridge. It would be up to your general counsel and a lot of other people to make the decision as to whether you would be allowed to set up a network like this. Considering you're at DHS, and actually engage foreign, non-governmental individuals. And that, you know, we are still hobbled by the security measures that forbid and disincentivize people who go out and engage foreigners. I mean, you're revealing, when you ask a question as a government analyst, you're revealing a gap in your knowledge. And when you ask it to someone overseas, you don't know how many other people are seeing that question. So it's difficult. That's the trusted element of our network, is you get people together who, you know, maybe are well known and are doing sensitive work on their own, people who have reputations, and you get around that element to a degree. But that is the big hurdle, is getting an analyst like yourself on there to ask the question, which, as Suzanne, I think, pointed out, can tend to take away some of the dynamism of the network. But there are ways to do it. You can meet with CSIS. We pitch the question. There's lots of different ways that can be done. I do think it's difficult because of the regulations that are still in place for you to actually sit on there and ask those questions until a lot of things change. But nonetheless, having think tanks or, you know, academic departments run a TIN, or business, a contractor to run a TIN, those are all distinct possibilities. In fact, this is the reality here. But to getting to that bridge, that's a tough leap. Yeah.
Bob Ross, DHS. I have some questions or some concerns about, I guess, mechanics related to sustainability. Overhead costs. I mean, what did this pilot project actually cost? The level of effort by the members of the network who are essentially volunteers, how much is too much, and at what point does it become necessary to provide other kinds of incentives, the actual money? Have you thought about the issue of permanent networks versus time-limited networks and the issue of static membership versus rolling membership?
Let me note these. Well, let me just say, compared to what the government might spend to do this, it's nothing, relatively small amount of money to do this, essentially to cover our time, the travel for the members, you know, several hundred thousand dollars total to run one of these. And it depends on how robust you want it. how often you want people to meet, what sort of technology is out there, the incentives. But we think we did something for far fewer dollars than government can do, and with very good results and with very good lessons for running the next model of it. How much effort is too much? It depends. Jonathan Weiner, one of our members, an advisor, not actually one of the academic team 10 members we chose, is on there like that. And he's, as for those people who know him, he's calling in. He's on there all the time, and he wants other members there all the time. And then you have other people who are gone for 3 months. Now, if you're Scott Atran, you brought the laptop with you, but others may not. But you have to get that guarantee, not a guarantee, but that commitment up front. You know, we want you on there once a week or twice a week to answer these questions. How much is too much? It depends on what you're asking folks to do. You know, we have people who came on all the time and people who couldn't come on more than a few times. So very difficult. Rolling membership. Again, if you're trying to get develop a trusted element and develop rapport among individuals, I think it's less likely to happen if you do have a rolling membership. But that's something we actually hadn't thought about, and that's interesting. Bringing in guest speakers is one of the more interesting things that we talked about. So that's I guess all I'd have to say on that. Yeah, go ahead, follow up.
In terms of rolling membership, I wasn't thinking about rapid rolling, but at some point, some people may have to drop out because of other demands on their time.
Yeah.
And they may find other people who are doing relevant research that you want to bring in.
Yeah.
And when you introduce new members into a network that's already formed,
Actually, we brought Zain Oberon in at the six-month mark. A few people dropped out at the beginning. And so we did invite new members in to fill gaps or because we found that they were doing very interesting things. In our assessment that we did and I see one of our friends from the Norwegian embassy here. We identified a few Norwegian researchers who are doing fantastic work on radicalization in Europe. And we invited one in. He did not have time to do it. Then we asked another to provide information. He gave us tons of relevant information. So as the network moves forward, that's one of the great benefits of it, is you can change it, you can modify it, you can direct it, and provided the members agree and it still is important for them, then they stick with it, and they did. But we did add new members, and some members dropped out. And, you know, when you talk about the trusted element, that does affect it at all. But we had Zainal come in, and she joined us in Brussels for the midterm review, and she fit in, and she provided actually some very good spark to the discussion. And some of the alternative views on what's causing radicalization in Europe. So it was actually very good. So I'm glad you asked that. Tim?
Tom, I was just going to make an observation that if you bear in mind that this is a simple early experiment, and so the format selected was this concept of a trusted information network. If you wanted to scale it to something that might be useful to the intelligence community or writ large, which would include Homeland Security, you have to really look beyond the concept of this simple intact network and think about ways in which the data might flow internally and then flow externally. So you wouldn't necessarily get the analyst inside the intelligence community to participate. You just want them to have access to the results. And that can be done in a lot of different ways. I don't think, Tom, you have to correct me on this, but I don't think CSIS is prepared to say what the extensions would be. But if you thought about ad hoc networks, the trusted network comes together, they come to some conclusion. When they've reached a natural end, we know as much as we're going to know about radicalization in Europe or returning jihadis, that group might go away, but the concept of forming new groups would continue to exist if there was some function in the government that would facilitate the formation of the group when there was a question at hand and then provide those resources and then allow it to go away. That's a mechanism by which you could have rolling questions answered with changing membership. But internal to the trusted information network, you have to maintain that trust if you're going to actually produce a result to the question.
Ken Roberts, DNI Analysis. I have a question that sort of relates to the past couple, and that's really, is there any follow-on to this specific project? Is the group just sort of disbanding and going away? or are they continuing on or going off in different directions?
Well, we are proposing soon a new phase to this, and we're going to sit down and discuss what the elements of it. This has to be funded from outside sources, and so that is part of the process. But we have tremendous amount of interest from the U.S. intelligence community as to the next iteration of this, from foundations, from other governments, from institutions who would like to see this move forward. When we briefed it to the Open Source Center, the old FBIS, they said, we'd like to see a second version of the same topic. And then others said, we'd like to see it on X, Y, and Z. Our program at CSIS is the Transnational Threats Project. So, you know, we focus on terrorism and organized crime and non-state threats. But certainly another part of CSIS or another institution could take it upon themselves to move it forward. But we are maintaining our connections with the 10 membership. They all still have the network. It's still operating in live. And you know when they're on because there's a green light that shows up next to their name. So they're also longstanding. Some of them are longstanding partners of our project and of CSIS. So we do envision a third phase, which would be the second 10, it'll be on some element of terrorism. We're not sure where it will be, but we'll discuss that with all involved. Anything else? Yes, Nadia. Yeah, that's a great point, Nadia. And again, going back to our discussion with the Open Source Center, we saw the future of the TIN on a pendulum where right now it's run exclusively by CSIS with periodic briefs to relevant government analysts, to a point where there's a model that is run by the government. Certainly, Arno, Jacqueline, and I would like to continue running TINs that are run by CSIS, where we do brief the results to the David Lowe's and the other individuals who are out there in government. David retired now, but people like that. And absolutely, it comes down to that flexibility, which is what is hampering government analysts in finding the context and perspective on the threat. Is they're not able to go out in an organized fashion to tap a sounding board like this. They can call in Sidney Jones, they can call in Olivier Waugh or Dan Benjamin to do one-off discussions, or Tom Fingar's organized group, but this is dynamic, it's persistent, year-long, and we think that version of having think tanks run it is something that should definitely be there in the future. We also think that there's a role for governments to create their own, but again, that is more restrictive, without a doubt. And that culture and those security regulations may be changing, but not nearly enough to make it as effective as one that's run by an outside organization.
Tom? I think that's a really important consideration to dwell a little bit more on, and it goes back to the question that Ron Marks raised earlier. If you're going to develop TINs or something like that within institutions, there is a greater concern as to what you end up with as an output product, as opposed to a diversified group of people that may have a rolling membership, but is constantly refreshed with its churn, but doesn't have an institutional bias or way of looking at things, or a single sponsor that has a sort of an implied set of biases. So it's this notion of diversity in intellectual points of view and experience that I think is so critical, that what CSIS has done here is to cull from the best internationally, from outside of a single organization, from within government, former government employees, analysts, academics, the cop on the beat. There have been just a tremendous amount of richness in the breadth of points of view that these people have brought to bear in the conversations, that you should be concerned when you start to think about creating a similar network, that it
gets more constricted within a single institution, that your output may also be more constricted.
Great. Thanks, Dick. To my left is Sabra Horn, who is helping lead the DNI's open source efforts and community-wide efforts, and in fact is going to be hosting the inaugural Open to All Individuals Internationally Open Source Conference this summer. Very oversubscribed and very popular, and we're happy to see that, but I think Sabra would like to make a couple comments.
We just wanted to say thank you so much to CSIS, Tom, and all of the partners that participated in this project, this incredibly innovative and exciting project, which is really helping to move forward the work of the intelligence community. Certainly, we cannot do what it is that we need to do by ourselves. We have to draw upon expertise outside the IC, and this helps us move forward in truly significant ways by better understanding virtual communities and how we do a better job of managing that expertise to what inside the IC is very focused on products, intelligence products, and certainly the conversations that take place are critical. I think it's going to be interesting to see as the years roll by how we do a better job of making use of these resources and these relationships. So thank you and congratulations.
Analysts within government.
I have many
thoughts on that, but I'd like maybe some of the former intelligence analysts in here to comment on that, if they so choose. Clearly, it's the fact, I'll just prompt it by saying it's the fact that much of what we need to know about new threats is available sometimes only in the open source, and finding that is can make a tremendous difference in your product. And in answering the question of a policymaker who asked a particular question.
What interested me a lot about analysts in the intelligence community is that I think the average length of service of an analyst in the U.S. intelligence community today is about 5 years. Therefore, this kind of an exercise becomes that much more important.
Tom, I would just leave two words of why someone would want to participate, if you're an analyst, is intellectual curiosity. That's what drives truly some of the great ideas and conclusions.
It can obviously cue your work. It really provides direction towards where you may want to drive your analysis in your work. John Nelson?
Just going to comment, maybe Suzanne can help me out here. It seems that, first of all, I'm not exactly sure if trusted is the right word and maybe restricted is the better word, because the idea of blogs and collaborative sites is that people share. And so, you want to have some boundaries on it. But it would seem to me, Suzanne, that maybe a next step is you've got this site which has a lot of valuable information. And maybe some of these govies here say, that third file up there, I wish my analysts could see. And maybe the way to go in the future, again, talking to the lawyer here, is almost a read-only approach for selected govies or whoever, and then some kind of VPN or tunneling access into it to keep the CI people happy. And it just doesn't seem that hard and to me. But it probably is. But it's got to be very frustrating to have this body of information not easily transmitted or accessible to, some GS-12 that could really benefit from it or could save a week's work with it. So I think if it's structured right, you can get away from the tasking and the U.S. citizen stuff, almost a read-only tunnel.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I use the term lurking, but, basically – it's a read-only function. It's an observation without the ability to interact. I think that's the simplest. I do think, as Tom said, you could find ways to get there to an interactive environment. But it would be it seems to me a relatively simple matter from a legal perspective to have observation.
Yeah, great suggestion, John. And that would leave the role open for CSIS or any other institution to determine the relevant questions, which, you know, we spend an awful lot of time on terrorism, and we interact with a lot of the government folks here. So we do know, to a large extent, we certainly know the unclassified version of what people are looking at inside the community, and we can continue to meet with them, pitch the questions, and then allow those folks to read just the responses. And that way you do avoid the tasking and the question issue. Ken, and then Suzanne.
In terms of incentives, I think it's really just doing a better job. And I think most of the issues are really more policy issues than legal, quite honestly. And what we're trying to push really is the concept that it really is a part of the analyst job, not just to sit in front of their computer all day long and react to classified information, but to really get out and network with the experts wherever they may be.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I just wanted to say something that may be obvious but may have been misleading by the use of the term lurk. Clearly what you need... because, you know, it's obvious to me that in order to have this trusted information network, you need transparency. So if you're going to have government officials observing, even in a read-only capacity, I think it would be incumbent on you to make sure that all the members of the TIN knew that and were comfortable with it, so that there's no, you know, it isn't being done, you know, without everybody's knowledge.
Yeah, exactly, because the paradigm hasn't quite shifted yet. We send hundreds of analysts to thousands of conferences or vice versa a year, and there's nothing wrong with them asking a bunch of experts at Harvard a bunch of questions, and we encourage that. Yet when we get into this kind of environment, we're suddenly, whoo. And so we've got to catch up. We've got to, you know, we're not aligned right for this, the velocity of information right now.
Yeah, but an indication of how far we have to go is that, as hard as it is to believe, in some government agencies, analysts still don't have the internet on their desk.
Yeah. We've heard some interesting stories, but without a doubt, that is the incentive: is you can tap this outside expertise.
Yeah.
In the back. Without a doubt. In fact, the last line in my conclusion in the report is, we want to hear from you. So please send us your ideas. That's why we have these roundtables. We're not here to tell you everything we think we know. We want to hear what you think about what we found in your own findings. So please contact Arno, Jacqueline, me, and we'd be happy to take your ideas. I mean, I've heard some great suggestions today on how to shape TIN too. So thank you for bringing that up, and we sincerely mean that. That's the role of CSIS, is to broker ideas from all different parties and use it to improve policy.
Okay. That just about wraps it up. Thank you so much for coming. It's been I think a very productive session, and you can see why I'm particularly proud of the team that has led this effort, and also Tom, thank you for doing what you did this morning. I think we've explained this concept very clearly, and we will certainly have an add-on with the help of our sponsors who are here today, and let me thank them once again. Nadia, I mentioned you at the beginning and mention you again. We could not have done it without the Smith Richardson Foundation. Thank you for coming. Tom, congratulations.